I'm convinced that more than half of it is actually not the techniques of the process. It's the shift in mindset. From kids do well if they wanna, I just gotta make them wanna, to kids do well if they can, to my kids doing the best they can to handle this very tricky situation with the skills they have, and some of these skills may be quite taxed right now. That perspective positions you in a really empathic place. And the interesting thing about that is when we are feeling that way, we're much more empathic, we're much calmer ourselves.
I'm Jill Shaw here with Ross Wilson, and this is a special deep dive for parents and caregivers.
Recently, Jill taped a conversation with Dr. Stuart Ablon, a psychologist at Mass General Hospital and one of the world's experts on having difficult conversations with kids.
Ross, I don't know about you, but I find it hard to talk to my kids about their social media habits, and I think that parents find this topic more difficult to address than other hard stuff like drinking, smoking, vaping, staying out late.
Jill, you and Stuart did a great job of making it easy to see how a parent could use his framework to have a pretty good conversation with their kids.
You know, his process really makes sense. It still made me cringe while I was working through it, but hopefully there's something in this conversation for every parent or caregiver listening. Enjoy, folks. Stuart, hi.
Hi.
How are you?
I am good. I'm thrilled to be here, so thanks for having me.
No, it's so great to have you here. And I've known about your work for a long time, but it's really nice to come together around the work that we've been doing with your brain on social media and to meet someone who can actually help parents have a conversation about this, because I personally have found it complicated with my two kids, specifically because it's hard to know exactly what the problem is. But I wanted to start by just talking a little bit about your work and where you started and how you ended up with the solution of collaborative problem solving.
Sure. So I grew up in a family with two mental health professionals as parents, which is usually a really bad sign for somebody how they're going to turn out.
That's why you're so grounded.
So I was always very interested in mental health and development and child psychology from the beginning, but I didn't really know exactly what I wanted to do. When I went to graduate school, I had this sort of split life where part of my time I worked with somebody who studied different forms of therapy. And I was studying what about those types of therapy were effective. So when they helped, why did they help? And that was really interesting in the beginning, but then it got sort of boring because we found the same thing across all different types of therapy was the biggest contributor to therapy being helpful. And that was the degree of helping relationship between the therapist and the client. Still to this day, this is the most consistent finding from therapy research, what we call therapy process research, that looks at process correlates of outcome. And what it says is that regardless of what form of therapy you're using, what technique you use, the most important driver of positive outcomes is the degree of helping relationship, which is sort of like—
Meaning trust, like how I feel about my therapist?
Yeah. Do you trust them? Do they see you through a lens of sort of non-judgmental acceptance and empathy? And do you feel a bond working together on tough stuff? And that's the biggest contributor to positive outcomes. So part of my life was studying that. And the other part was working with one of the world's experts on kids with externalizing behaviors. Okay. So oppositional, defiant, aggressive behaviors. And we were using their really traditional behavior modification techniques, rewards and consequences, to try to change these kids' behavior. And I was really struck with these two worlds that it didn't make a ton of sense that sort of lording our power over these kids with rewards and consequences would help build a helping relationship with them. And so I was like, how do you put these two worlds together? And frankly, when kids aren't behaving so well, it's pretty hard to develop a good helping relationship with them. So I came to the work from that sort of dual experience. And then I was lucky enough to come to Mass General Hospital, do my fellowship there at Mass General and Harvard Medical School, where I met a guy by the name of Dr. Ross Green, who was beginning to put together some ideas from a very different vantage point, because he came from a sort of more hardcore behaviorist standpoint, where I was learning about different types of psychotherapy. But he was seeing the downsides of those interventions as well. And we came together and writing and teaching and researching, and a couple decades later, we have an approach called collaborative problem solving that's sort of used around the world in all kinds of settings.
So you were you always working with kids, adolescents?
Yes. Yes. I mean, I worked with adults too, and I still do some work with adults, but frankly, I prefer hanging out with kids.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, they're very endearing. And so collaborative problem solving, you're now using this work. And can you talk a little bit about the range of work you do? You talked yesterday when we were talking with you about working with the NYPD.
Yeah.
But you also work with families.
Yeah.
That's quite a broad range. You work in schools.
It is.
How is the work similar? How is it different? Yeah. Are there tougher cases, easier cases? And then how do you like ground it in just everyday life of parenting and using the technique?
Well, it started as a parenting approach. Okay. First and foremost, it started as a parenting approach late 90s, trying to help parents who were basically saying, using sort of traditional rewards and consequences to try to motivate my kid to behave better, not only isn't working, but often seems to make matters worse. What's going on and what else can I do? So it started as a parenting approach. Hmm. Then actually a local hospital here, a very sort of progressive nurse manager of a psychiatric unit for children said, you know, I think we could use this here because we get into all kinds of trouble when we try to enforce the rules in traditional ways with these kids.
Yeah.
And we have to do restraints and seclusions and there's injuries and property damage and it's awful and it's traumatic. And most of these kids have trauma histories to begin with. We're doing something wrong. And so we taught the staff there how to do it and they eliminated their use of restraints and seclusions on this locked inpatient psychiatry unit. And then other units started hearing about it. And then we started working with the residential treatment facilities. And then therapeutic schools started coming interested. And then regular education, mainstream classrooms. And now, you know, as you mentioned, we do work with school safety, like the NYPD we did a big project with. We do work a lot of work in child welfare, foster care, correctional systems. And I think the reason, which is so exciting, is all the basics that we'll talk about, I'm sure, today apply across all human interaction. I mean, my big interest is children and adolescents, but anywhere humans are having a hard time getting along with each other, which is everywhere, these ideas
right now,
apply.
Yeah. It's, you know, as you're talking, it's very poetic in a way that someone who's taking care of kids who are in difficult circumstances, who are suffering from mental illness, can go from needing to restrain a child to being able to use voice and words and building a different sort of relationship to have a better effect.
Yes.
And still restraining the behavior that they wanted to restrain, but without the physical
tactics. Yeah, I mean, we teach people to sort of, you know, get their expectations met with kids, to achieve compliance, frankly, with things we think are important for kids to comply with, but to do it by collaboration instead of by sort of leveraging the power differential that adults have over kids. It is poetic, and you said, you mentioned sort of use words to do this. Which, you know, the more we learn about the human brain, the more we learn that the parts of the brain that are involved in understanding language and communication are the same parts of the brain that are involved in regulating our emotions and our whole system, which means one of the things people have learned is you can use words to regulate someone else or to dysregulate them. I always say to people, the most powerful example of this is, you know, you can be talking on the phone, just the old-fashioned phone, just words, right? No visuals, to somebody thousands of miles away. And what you say to that person has the ability to literally change their heart rate, their blood pressure, their, you know, their whole psychophysiology,
right,
for the better or for the worse. You can dysregulate them or regulate them with your words, which is in essence a large part of what we teach people to do.
Yeah, it's an incredible power. And to get into collaborative problem solving a little bit, you start with an assumption that is really a reframing of how traditionally kind of this authority has worked with adults over kids. And can you talk a little bit about what that change in paradigm is?
Yeah, we basically have a philosophy that underlies all of our work.
Yeah.
And when it's applied to kids, what it says is kids do well if they can, which on the surface may not sound too powerful, but when you unpack it, it really is powerful. Because what kids do well if they can says is we believe if a kid could do well, could handle whatever situation they're facing well, they would.
Right.
And if they're not, something's got to be getting in their way. And it can't be as simple as they're just not trying hard enough. Because most people approach interactions with kids that are fraught more through the lens of kids do well if they want to.
Right.
Which means if they're not doing well, we assume
they're choosing not to do well.
Yeah, they're not wanting to do well. So then what do? We try to make them want to do well, which is a very narrow, unpleasant, ineffective role.
And traditionally you're saying we do that with carrots and sticks.
You got it. Rewards, and, consequences.
Because you could. And so I just need to make you want to. And you're saying if they could, they would.
Yeah. And that's our feelings. Kids do well if they can. I've yet to meet the kid who prefers doing poorly to doing well. And,
right.
When I think back your question about where did this all start, one of my observations when I was working with these kids who were really struggling at home and at school with their behavior, they were miserable.
Mm.
And their parents were miserable, too.
Yeah.
And the idea that we were just needing to supply motivation to them to behave better, it just made no sense. I mean, they're the most motivated people on the earth to behave better. Right. Like, I always tell people, there are a lot of kids running around who aren't motivated to behave well. You know who those kids are, ironically? They're well-behaved kids.
Yeah.
They're the kids who just have the skills to be able to handle things, and it's pretty easy for them. So you don't have to work very hard as a parent because they can meet your expectations. The kids who are struggling, ironically, they're trying harder than anybody else. And, one analogy I like to use is think of it as like a learning difference or a learning disability almost.
Right.
Where, when we were in grade school—
Not that we're old.
Not that we're old.
Yes,
this
a
is
little
just a
while
few
ago.
Years ago. 10 maybe?
Right, right.
No, I'll speak for myself. How about that? if you go back, say, 40 years in time and put me in a fifth grade classroom, I'm giving myself a little slack there.
Well, then we need to talk about aging strategies also.
So if you put me in fifth grade, I'm 10 years old, 40 years ago, and I was reading, say, more like a second grader back then, so there was like a 3-year difference.
Yeah.
40 years ago, people, very caring at the time, well-trained educators, would have thought that I was either lazy or dumb.
Yeah.
They would not have suspected that actually there was something I struggled with, and ironically that I was trying harder than anybody else to read.
Right. Whereas as you're describing that right now, probably everyone who's listening to this is saying, well, of course, this person has a learning disability.
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely.
That's become mainstream thinking for us.
It has, but not when it comes to behavior. If somebody is struggling with whatever challenge is in front of them behaviorally, we still assume they're not trying hard enough, where the same thing is true. They're trying harder than anybody else because they're struggling to handle that expectation or that challenge in front of them.
But can you talk we're going to get to the social media and how to talk to your kids about social media, but I think this is important because we're faced right now with this rise in mental illness, and we're talking about something that we don't really diagnose, which is, this lack of particular skills developmentally, which puts a kid at a disadvantage when it comes to regulating and performing as well as they want to.
And puts them at significant risk for mental health issues. I mean, this we need to underline here. Sometimes people look at our work and they think, oh, they deal with behavior.
Mm.
People don't realize that behavioral challenges are the canary in the coal mine when it comes to mental health challenges.
Right.
And emerging research shows that actually across every major diagnostic category, psychiatric diagnoses, the underlying issues that begin have to do with behavior. So there's a clear connection, okay? And it's not surprising because the kinds of skills that our research and others have shown that kids who struggle to manage their behavior, that they struggle with, are skills related to things like problem solving, flexibility, frustration tolerance. And all these things are at the roots of all forms of major mental health issues. So, this is crucial at this point in time where our kids are struggling just unbelievably with their mental health.
Right. But these are skills that can be developed. This is the point.
This is the point. If it's kids do well if they want to, we just got to make them want to.
Right.
Good luck if that's not working. But this is very optimistic news that this is about skill, not will.
Right.
Skills can be built. Just like you can teach a kid how to decode words phonetically, you can teach kids how to be more flexible, tolerate frustration, problem solve better. And by the way, we're speaking pretty casually about this, but the skills, the neuropsychological skills that sort of amount to being able to problem solve, tolerate frustration, and be flexible, they are skills across a range of different domains: language and communication, attention and working memory skills, emotion and self-regulation skills, social thinking skills, cognitive flexibility skills. So again, we're talking about the neuropsychological correlates to most mental health challenges.
And this is, I started to equate it to all kinds of training as you were talking about this with us, that if parents can learn this very simple approach, which we're going to go through in a minute, it's really like going out and like volleying tennis balls with your kid, or, you know, kicking a soccer ball around or shooting hoops. Is you're building memory, muscle memory, kind of, that actually helps your brain start to move in the direction of more flexibility, better problem solving.
Absolutely.
All of these things. It's another skill that we should be giving to our children.
Absolutely. And my, perhaps my favorite set of findings from our research team, because we study everything we do, you know, being at a big research hospital like Mass General, one of the things we found is that when adults practice collaborative problem solving, so they collaborate with their kids to try to solve problems using the process we'll talk about, kids develop the very sets of skills that I just talked about. And even cooler, guess who else starts to develop those skills?
The adult.
Yes.
Yeah. It's really amazing.
Yeah. Adults, our research has shown they become more flexible thinkers, more empathic, better perspective takers, and better at solving problems by practicing this. And, you know, you were talking about repetition.
Yeah.
I think it's really important whenever we're talking about building a new skill. And here we're talking about kids building a new skill, but we're also talking about us adults, we have to build a new skill to help our kids build this skill, right?
Totally, yes.
But for kids and adults, whenever you're talking about building skills, what you're talking about is literally changing the brain. And a skill only appears when you have built a new neuronal pathway in the brain.
Right.
And, you know, we know a lot more than we used to about how you build new pathways in the brain.
Yeah.
And one of the main things is repetition.
Yeah.
Repetition, repetition, repetition. The other thing, I think it's going to be a good lead into the rest of the conversation, that you need is you need stress. Believe it or not, the brain does not change without little doses of stress, what neurobiologists call good stress.
Right.
So when we parents try what we're going to talk about, and it's not easy, it's hard and it's stressful in a different way because it feels different. It may not go so smoothly right in the beginning. That is proof positive that you are stretching and you are trying to build some new pathways. Same with our kids. When it doesn't all go beautifully with them because they're stuck a little in the mud, that's when you know, aha, we are working hard to carve new pathways in the brain right now.
Yeah, it's really amazing. And I think every time I hear people talk about this, and I didn't think about this as being one of those things where you're kind of on the edge, you know, having to do something that you don't really want to do, but that's the time at which you're developing new neural pathways that are,
you got it.
You know, they're good for anti-aging, right?
They are. Well, and look, it's also very good news that we adults can develop these skills.
Yes, totally.
I mean, you know the old adage of you can't teach an old dog new tricks. It's actually not true.
It's very true.
And there's a lot in the popular media about, like, you know, brains being fully formed by 24 or 26. It makes us adults feel like, uh-oh. It's so not true. You can change the adult brain. It is harder than changing a child's brain
because
we're a little less malleable. But if you follow what we call basic principles of neuroplasticity, which is how do you change the brain? We adults can change our brains too.
So let's try doing it. So we're going to talk about social media. I need your help talking to my daughter, who's 17, about social media, about her use.
All right. Let's do it.
Okay. So can you first just give us the highlights? What are there's three steps, right, to your process.
Yeah.
And so maybe just talk a little bit about what each step is, and then we'll try to apply it.
Sure. So the first step is the hardest and the most important. We call it, which is not going to be surprising here, the empathy step, okay? Although we're very clear that, you know, I think sometimes people misunderstand the word empathy, and they think you just sort of need to quickly show your kids you care, which can be accomplished by saying something like, I know this is really hard for you, but, which I call drive-by empathy at best. Actually, what we like to emphasize is empathy means to understand.
Okay.
And so the goal of this first ingredient we call empathy is to understand your child's perspective or point of view, their concern, to really get where they're coming from with whatever aspect of, in this case, social media you're talking about.
Okay.
So that's, and we'll go into more detail, but that's the first ingredient. And only once you really understand where they're coming from, do we say to us adults, okay, now it's time for us to be able to share where we're coming from, our perspective, what we're worried about, our concern. Okay, but notice, not our solution that we want to impose to fix the problem, but what we're worried about. And once we have those two on the table, we can go to the third ingredient, which is when we then invite our kids to collaborate with us and give them actually first shot at trying to develop a solution. And what kind of a solution? One that addresses both of those concerns that you've clarified in the first two steps.
Right.
So those are the three steps. There's a lot, it seems simple. As you've heard me say before, don't confuse simple with easy.
Yes.
There's a lot packed into these three. But I also, before we get into the details, I want to emphasize that, again, where it gets tough in each of these three ingredients is just because you are running into skills your child is struggling with or you are struggling with. So expect it to get a little gritty.
Right. And I found, the big in sort of preparing to have this conversation, I was trying to decide, what is my problem? Because I see her on her phone and I see her on social media and I see that in many different places, right? In the car when I'd like to have a conversation with her, sometimes at the dinner table and I have to ask her to put it away, or maybe later at night. But I also know, right, that this thing, unlike in my lifetime, it was not a part of me. And so I don't carry it around with me all the time. And I lose it all the time. It's attached, it is attached to her, just like it's attached to every other. Yeah, exactly. And that her social network, is with her all the time. And maybe that there's some importance to that I don't understand. She's a very social being. But I think it's really about kind of dialing it down, maybe particularly when I'm around.
Uh-huh.
And so is this more about me than it is about her?
Well, it's always about both of us in cases like this. But I think one of the things that you're hitting upon right now, which is really important, is don't try to use collaborative problem solving to solve the problem of social media in general with your daughter or you're on your phone too much.
Yeah.
That's too vague and amorphous of a problem to solve. So, one of the things that's key with any form of problem solving is to try to be specific about what part of this problem you're trying to solve. Because the reality is you're probably going to need multiple conversations about different aspects. And I always recommend pick low-hanging fruit to start. Pick like one instance that's really predictable, one issue that you're concerned about. Don't make it the hardest one just yet. And let's get a track record of this kind of collaborative conversation working. So I would suggest you sort of dial in on one aspect of that. And then the other thing is, before you start this conversation, you can also get crystal clear about, well, what is your concern about her being on her phone at dinner time or in the car or at night. Like, let's get clear on what you're really worried about ahead of the conversation, because that prepares you. Then the real hard work that you can't really prepare for is the empathy step.
Okay. I think my biggest issue is that I don't value the content that I suspect she's looking at on social media to be as valuable as other content that she could be, whether that's interacting with real humans or reading a book or diving more deeply into her homework. I have this sense, I have this belief that there's no way that the content that she's scrolling through is as valuable as other things that she could be doing.
So I would just ask you to sort of drill down a little bit more. So you're worried actually that what she's looking at is sort of taking away from other things that she could be doing that would be more valuable, more enriching, et cetera.
At the best and at the worst, at certain times I've worried that she's reading things that are not true, right? So she's developing a set of facts that...
Got it.
But not doing fact checking.
So this is where the plot thickens, right?
Yeah.
Because basically, like most adults in most situations, you have multiple concerns. It's not as simple as you've just got one concern, right? So you've got multiple concerns and you need to decide at the outset, do you want to pursue both of those concerns in this case or one at a time?
Right.
Now, again, I want to be careful.
This is quickly where I decide, okay, I don't feel like talking about this.
Yeah, because it's overwhelming, right? But what I would say to you is, okay, hold on a sec. Just let's narrow in here. That's all. Let's narrow into a situation that you find particularly problematic, a time of day, or to, one of those concerns, or those two concerns could be addressed at the same time. The reality is, your daughter probably has multiple concerns too.
Totally.
So
yes,
that's okay.
Good point.
So if I were to say to you, okay, it sounds like you're clear that what you're worried about is that your daughter's spending a fair amount of time on her phone, scrolling on her phone, and you're worried that it's taking away from time that she could be doing other valuable things. And I'd be careful about saying more valuable because, you know, you could agree to disagree here.
Yeah, that's a good point.
But other valuable things. And you're even worried about her sort of learning things all from a skewed perspective that may not be fact-based.
Right. Yes.
Okay. So you've got those clear. I often say to parents, you know what, since this whole thing's so overwhelming, you can write those down.
Yeah.
Okay. Because that you can be prepared for.
Right.
And the other thing, by the way, that you can be prepared for is when to have this conversation. And, you know, this is one of the things that social media has made really challenging. Because the times of day that we could usually have a conversation with our kids are now the times of day where they're on their phone scrolling. Because cars used to be the best place to have a conversation with kids. Dinner time, bedtime, things like this. So you're going to have to think about, okay, when is a decent time where she's less likely to want to be on her phone? She's in a decent mood, a decent place. Like, let me pick my time and place. And I often say to people also, you may want to pick an activity of something.
Right.
I mean, I don't know if, you know, if guys ever go for a walk or, you know, you mentioned you throw a ball, so anything.
Or out hiking,
Yeah,
no, that makes total sense. Because I do, I think the thing about, like, I used to find the car to be a very easy place to have a conversation. But now I just feel like you can so quickly turn back to your phone to process there as opposed to just continuing to process with the car. Okay.
Now, and let's be clear, it is also okay to say to your daughter, can you put your phone away so we can have a conversation, right? But, you know, one little trick about the places to have conversations is, you know, there's a reason the car was a good place because, you know, the same reason when our kids couldn't fall asleep, we'd stick them in the car and drive around until they fell asleep. The cars have a sense of movement to them that is very regulating. Which is the same thing about hiking. It's listening to music. It's a sort of repetitive, back and forth, often rhythmic feel, which, not to get too deep on you here, but it actually, the reason these things are regulating, people don't realize, is because they, in essence, evoke the earliest regulating mechanisms, which is, in utero, mom's heartbeat.
Oh, that's so interesting.
It's the same reason rocking, by the way, tends to regulate kids. And by the way, most people rock a baby at about the same cadence as the average maternal heartbeat.
Oh, that's
wild. So it's a rhythmic, repetitive back and forth that regulates. And this is why it still happens when you're taking a walk or you're throwing a ball. And you'll even notice the conversation we're going to talk about is intended to be rhythmic, repetitive, back and forth, hear from your daughter, share your concern, going to hear a little bit more from her, back and forth before you're going to problem solve.
All right. So let's, I think I'm going to have this conversation while we go out hiking.
Okay.
And so.
Can I actually add one more thing then? Just to help us parents get as prepared as possible.
Absolutely.
Right? So it's like. You've written down your concerns. You've decided when and where you're going to have the conversation. Okay. There's one other thing you can prepare, which is how you're going to kick it off.
Right.
Because I got to tell you, so many times these conversations are doomed from the first phrase that comes out of the adult's mouth, because it sounds something like, we got to have a talk, or can we talk about something? And most kids' response to that is, oh, God.
So I shouldn't start by saying, I would like to have a hard conversation.
Probably not. Okay. So what I recommend to people is just start with like as neutral as possible of an observation.
Okay.
Okay. So, and you could say something, you should use your own words so it doesn't sound artificial, but, you know, something along the lines of, it looks like, or it seems as if, or I've noticed that. Okay. So like, for instance, and this may not sound like you, but, you know, given what you're describing, you could be like, hey, you know what? I've just noticed lately that a lot of times when I've been with you, it seems like you're on your phone a lot. Now, that already sounds hugely judgmental.
Yeah, I know. I was going to say, I think she would like.
So you can immediately
give me the side eye.
And she will give you the side
eye. Yeah.
And so you immediately are going to back that up with something like, don't worry, this is not going to be a lecture. You're not in trouble.
Yeah.
And I'm just curious. And I just want to sort of understand and learn a bit more. Okay. You'll have to figure out how you're going to do it yourself.
Right.
But you want to enter it as neutrally as possible and reassure them this is not a lecture coming her way.
So when I do that, when I introduce this topic, I'm wondering about what you look at most when you're on social media. Is that a fair thing? Or does that make it? Okay.
Because you're being a detective.
Yeah.
Which is what I tell parents to do in this first ingredient.
Right.
Be a detective. Try to gather information.
Right. And I wonder about that because, you know, there's lots on social media that is Now I'm making.
You're jumping right to your concern, though, aren't you?
Oh, I can't express my concern because we have to go into part two.
No, because otherwise the problem is as soon as a kid hears the adult concern, what they think is this. Oh, I know this conversation. Mm-hmm. This is why I shouldn't be on social media that much.
Oh, so I should be asking her, just let it lie.
You need to bite your tongue on your concern, which is why you're bringing this up in the first place.
Right.
And just try to gather information from you. So you started great by being, I'm curious what you're spending your time on. And let's say for the sake of argument, it sounds like this is not the case because I'm sure you've peaked. But let's say she's like, I like to just tear through the New York Times as much as I can. And then, you know, I hit the Wall Street Journal and, you know.
They're liars.
I mean, honestly, we're joking now, but I do have to tell people, be prepared for surprises. If you do a good job in this first ingredient of gathering information from you, you're going to learn some stuff. And some stuff may change or shift your perspective as well.
Yes.
So don't sort of, you know, bite your tongue on your concern and just gather information. I'm curious, you know, what you're spending most of your time on. I really am interested. Can you fill me in?
What if she says, you know, honestly, most of the time I look at pictures of cute animals.
you say, join the rest of the world.
Exactly. No, exactly.
So here's where I think this ingredient.
This is actually a conversation I've had, so I could tell you. And that was the answer.
So yeah. Well, hey, it could be much worse things.
And then I said, so why is that interesting?
Uh huh. That's fair.
You said it just calms me down.
Uh huh. Great.
Yeah.
Okay. So let me just for folks listening. In this first ingredient, when people are often like, what do I say next?
Yeah.
What do I do if she doesn't say anything? What do I do if she says I'm mostly looking at funny animal things? What do I do? I spent about 5 years listening to and watching all the recordings we had of people doing this.
Yes.
And what I sat there trying to sort of code, if you will, when this first ingredient goes well and we get information, we learn from our kids, what are we doing? And when it doesn't go well, what are we doing? And it was really fascinating because, in essence, when it goes well and we're gathering information, we're doing four things and four things only. And if we do anything else than that, it usually goes awry. So here are the four things. Ready? Ask questions, basic, right? Yeah. Like you're one of, what are you looking at?
Right.
Okay. Take guesses if need be.
Ah.
So if she said, I don't know.
Yeah.
You may say something like, are you like on Instagram most of the time? Some. So what are you looking at? Question on Instagram. I don't know. I mean, sometimes I when I can see, it looks like you're looking at like videos of animals and stuff.
Right.
Is that? So this is questions and guesses.
Yeah.
Okay. If the other two tools are this, reflective listening and reassurance. Okay. Questions and guesses will help get you information.
Yeah.
Reflective listening and reassurance will help engage your child in the conversation. And if need be, calm them down and regulate them.
Okay.
Reflective listening is as simple as repeating back in your own words, not their words, because that's annoying to just parrot back to kids, especially adolescents, but in your own words, what you heard from them.
Okay.
Say
so
exactly.
She says, seriously, she says, I'm honestly looking at funny pictures of animals.
Oh, gotcha. So you're looking at pictures of like videos and things of animals doing funny stuff.
Yeah, hamsters, look.
So most of the time, that's what you're doing, you think?
Oh, that's good.
So, see, most of the time, we don't drill down enough. We're like, oh, got it. Okay, let's move on because I'm anxious to get to my concern.
Right.
But no, I want to spend time here.
Okay.
So most of the time?
And then I'm on Snapchat, but just checking out where people are or answering. You know, it's amazing how many times I take pictures of myself and send it to other people.
Got it. I don't think she would say that. I don't think kids are amazed about that at all. they probably think they could send more ridiculous pictures of themselves and show people
too.
Where they are. But all kidding aside, all I'm going to do while I listen to you is if you tell me anything, I'm going to sort of indicate to you
Feed
that I've heard you.
Yeah.
And I'm going to keep deepening. I'm going to keep drilling down. I'm going to ask some questions. I'm going to take some guesses. I'm going to reflect what I've heard. And if you start to shut down on me, I'm going to reassure you. So this is what it looked like. Oh, so, okay, so a lot of animal stuff, and then you're also on Snapchat, it sounds like. And if I'm hearing you right, you're on Snapchat just like taking pictures of yourself so people can see what you're up to and things, but you're also checking where people are on the Snap map.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
Got it. Okay. Now I'm going to try some reassurance. And look, I'm not trying to judge here. I'm really just trying to understand, right? And so you're saying you're doing the animal stuff because it's like calms you down.
Yeah. They're really cute.
And why do you think you're on Snapchat so much? I mean, I'm just curious, the pictures and checking where people are.
Yeah, because everyone's on there.
Uh-huh.
I think that's the way that I don't use text that much. I just Snapchat with people.
So that's how you communicate.
Yeah.
Okay. And the map thing, like checking where people are, what's the deal with that?
Well, it's such a good question because I don't know the answer, but that's a good question.
Yeah. Is it just curiosity? Here's educated guess. Just curiosity or like, I mean, I could see, you know, sometimes you might be like trying to check because you're worried about what people are up to or something, but I don't know. What do you think?
Okay, let me ask you a question though.
Yeah.
So at this point, when I'm asking this many questions of either child, that they're like, what? You know, like, what are you trying to say?
And what I would say to, I'm just really trying to understand where you're coming from. And here's where I'm going to dip my toes into my concern.
Okay.
Because they're basically asking, why you want to have this conversation? And I'll say something like, to be honest, I mean, I do have some concerns about how much you're on your phone. And don't worry. This is not a conversation about how I'm going to make you use your phone less or things like that. Mm-hmm. I don't even sort of fully understand why you're on, you know, scrolling so much. So I'm trying to understand and you're helping me do that. And once I sort of feel like I understand where you're coming from, then I do want to share where I'm coming from with this.
Okay.
And by the way, most parents are like, okay, the second I indicate that I have some concerns, my kid's going to start getting upset or shutting down. And my answer to that is, yeah, they are. Absolutely.
Okay.
Because they're afraid that this is now heading in the direction of a solution that's going to address the parental concern and not the child's concern.
So is that then the parent on the parent side when you're expressing your concern is the strategy to do it as concisely as possible?
Absolutely as concisely. Because as a dad of three, like it is so easy for us to drone on forever, especially because we're like, I just did all that listening. Thank God it's my chance now. Okay. So you do want to be as succinct as possible. But also I tell people, you know, these three ingredients, you empathize first, understand your kid's concern, then you share yours, then you're going to problem solve. That's the order. But if at any point it goes awry, what you do is you go back to the first ingredient, because the first ingredient, empathy, is the only one that's regulating or calming.
Right.
So if you say, I do have some concerns, maybe your daughter goes, oh God, I knew it.
Yeah.
And that's when you go right back to the first, you don't continue. Well, here are my concerns.
Yeah.
You say, whoa, hold on a second. Look, I heard you.
Yeah.
That you like watching animal videos because it calms you down. And you know what? Like you got a lot of going on in your life. Like, to have something calms you down is a good thing. I hear that.
Yeah.
And it also hears this is how you stay connected to your friends. And we haven't quite figured out exactly why the map's important, but it sounds like that's important too. I hear you.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying those things shouldn't be important to you. I'm just saying that, you know, I have some concerns and now I'd probably present mine.
Okay.
And I'm just worried that like, you know, sometimes it feels like to me that you're doing those things so much that it might get in the way of you doing other things that might be valuable. And look, I sometimes wonder about, you know, are you getting information that's based in facts? But what I'm hearing you say is you're spending most of the time on Snapchat and looking at funny videos. So it sounds like maybe that's not what I should be as much worried about. But I am a little worried about, you know, it takes away from other things you could be doing.
Right.
Now, if she's still with you, you can go to the third ingredient because you have two sets of concerns on the table and she's still with you. If she's not with you, go back to the first ingredient and re-regulate her.
Right.
Okay.
And you re-regulate by talking through what she's just said.
Exactly. By reminding her you haven't
lost
sight.
You've heard her, and you understand it.
Dedicated to making sure that her concerns are going to get addressed and you're not just going to impose a solution.
Yep. Okay.
You know, one of my colleagues that I work closely with, who's a noted trauma researcher, he has this great thing he teaches where it's this sort of rubric where he says, it goes like this, regulate, relate, reason. And what he says is you've got to regulate people before they're going to relate to you, before you can talk to their cortex, the smart part of the brain, and reason with them. Regulate, relate, reason.
Right.
And there's a neurobiologic reason for that because, you know, information doesn't hit the smart part of our brain first and we're not ready to reason immediately.
It's so unfortunate.
Well, amygdala. We'd be extinct. Otherwise.
Okay,
so there's a good reason for it.
Okay.
But if we're regulated, information can move up the brain so that we can relate to people, and then eventually to the smart part of our brain. So the reason he and I, if people want to check him out, by the way, his name is Dr. Bruce Perry, great person to learn from. But the reason he and I do a lot of work together is these three ingredients that we're talking about are a roadmap to regulate with the first ingredient.
Yeah.
Relate, say, okay, now you try to listen to my concern with the second ingredient. And then here comes the third ingredient we're about to talk about. Let me talk to your cortex and see if we can do some problem solving.
Right.
Regulate, relate, reason. Don't do them out of order. And what I'm saying to you is if at any point, maybe you've regulated really well, you share your concern, she gets dysregulated. Don't go ask to talk to her cortex.
Right.
Go back.
Go back.
Regulate her. Relate again. And now we're finally going to get to the third ingredient where it's time to collaborate.
Okay. And how do you lead in with that? Yeah, I've presented my concerns. I understand she's hearing me and she knows that I've heard her concerns.
Yep. How do you lead it? And actually one important clarification, because I think as parents, we often say to ourselves, but what if she does, like she heard my concerns?
Yes.
But she's not really bought into them.
Mm.
Like she's not invested in them.
Right.
And you know what I say? I say, that's fine.
Okay.
She doesn't have to own your concerns. They're your concerns. She's
right.
not the parent.
Right.
Just like, you've heard her concerns, but do you buy them? Are you like, oh my God, now that I heard you, I think Snapchat is so great. Right? Like,
right.
no,
right.
You just have to take them into account.
Right.
And so if your kid even says, because for some parents out there, your kid would be like, well, you know what? I don't care. Because you don't even like know how to use your phone. So like, I don't care what your concerns are.
Well, I think this is the hard part about social media, right? Because I feel much more comfortable having a conversation with her about vaping.
Yeah.
Because the evidence is so, I can just refer to, I don't want you vaping, you know, like the pre-conversation. And here's all of the reasons. Here's what happens to your brain when you do it. I feel so comfortable having that conversation. Yeah. If she, you know, pushes back or suggests that there's a realm in which it's a good idea for her, because I can continuously have a very calm conversation about why that doesn't. With social media, I think even though there's data coming at us from all different, and people are expressing so many different views on why this is bad for our kids and it's correlative to the rise in mental illness, it's so hard to express those raging concerns.
Yeah.
Like that's what I think is driving the conversation ultimately is, I don't know what it's going to do to you. And I feel like you're on it all the time.
Although I would say listening to you and listening to many parents, I'm also hearing that, so you've got those big raging concerns and the research, and of course.
My amygdala is flying.
But you also have really immediate personal concerns.
Yes.
That you're like, you know, even if there wasn't all this research out there, like, the fact that I'm sitting in the car and we're not talking to each other and she's on her phone looking at animal videos, like that just doesn't feel so good relationally. And I'm worried about that.
Right.
And by the way, that's the intermediary, one of them, you know, for these raging concerns we have. So I think we're more effective as parents when our concerns are grounded in our interactions with our kids.
Yeah.
Yes, we can cite the research and things like that.
Yeah.
But frankly, you know, the kids are also aware of this research, believe it or not, which is what's also fascinating. If you spend a good deal of time listening to your kids, when you express your concern, they often are like, yeah, I'm worried about that too.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember a conversation I had with my daughter last year when she was 16, where I made the mistake of leading way too much with my own concerns.
Yeah.
But she shocked me by agreeing with many of them. And I was sort of like, wait a minute. And it led to this fascinating conversation about how hard it is to make change and stop with something that is so addictive, which of course is another concern that we have.
Right.
But you know, my point is with you raise your concern, they don't have to buy it hook, line, and sinker. You don't have to agree. You just have to say, okay, that's your concern, that's mine. Now let's go to the third ingredient. And you asked, how do you lead into that? I suggest you lead into it with an invitation to brainstorm solutions together. And, you know, words I like to use are things like, so I wonder if there's a way, or more optimistic, I bet there's a way. I'm sure there's something we could do so that, and then just recap what you've learned. So that, and notice something interesting here. I'm not going to recap her solutions, but her concerns. One of her solutions to wanting to calm down is animal videos.
Right.
But I'm going to go like this. Not, I wonder if there's a way that you can keep watching animal videos. I'm going to say, I wonder if there's a way that you can have a time and space to calm down when you feel like calming down.
Yeah.
And you can be connected to your friends and to the extent you need to know what where they are and what they're up to. Mm-hmm. And it can leave time for you to do some other things that I think are valuable too. And like, let me just be more specific, like for us to have some conversations at times or for you to read other things. This is where I would just be a little bit more specific. And then I think this is really hard for us parents. When you put the invitation out there that recaps the problem we're trying to solve, give your kid first crack at solutions by saying to her, so what do you think? Do you have any ideas? And also very hard for us is then bite our tongue and just zip it and wait. And I often suggest it's going to feel excruciating, but you can count in your head to like 30.
Oh, God.
Right? If you really do it, it's excruciating.
Yeah.
But actually, you want to give your kid some time to think. And too often we'll say, do you have any ideas? And they'll be like, nope. And you'll be like, well, how about this? Right? So when a kid says no, I usually say, oh, well, that was super quick. Like, this is complicated. It's going to take some thinking. So just give it a thought for a little bit and you take a bit. I'll take a bit too. Because what we're trying to do is, remind, what do you think? Okay? Now, obviously, a kid taking first crack is important because if they come up with an idea, they're going to be much more invested in following through on that, right? There's much more buy-in.
Right.
But notice we're also asking them to practice. Practice doing what? Come up with a solution that is mutually satisfactory, realistic, and doable, which entails listening to somebody else's perspective, keeping in mind theirs, generating alternative ideas. In other words, all kinds of language and communication, flexible thinking, social thinking skills are practiced naturalistically problem solving like this.
That's why the 30 seconds is so important.
It is.
Yeah.
It is. If she doesn't have an idea, you can suggest one.
Mm-hmm.
I just would say, suggest it tentatively. Like maybe you might be like, well, I mean, one thought I had is even if just like in the car home from school, you know, maybe if you put the phone down and we were able to have, you know, a conversation for a bit, like that's one step in the direction of addressing the concerns. But I realize that we also need to make sure that you have time and space to sort of calm down and chill. So I don't know, do you feel like you need that right after school? And this is where we're just trying to collaborate. And on any solution that is mutually satisfactory, works for you and her, realistic and doable.
Right. And so generally speaking, when you have parents practicing this or teachers or other caregivers, as they continue to use these strategies, do kids get better at, they feel more comfortable providing the ideas?
Kids will often lead the process, which is one of the coolest things we've found is
so
if you do this a lot, they get used to it. And when you'll say something like, so I've noticed that, okay, what do you want to talk about? They'll say. And they'll get right down to business filling you in. I mean, I've even had kids that sort of really lead the process by, they'll say, okay, so tell me what you're worried about. Like if you use the language, they will use it with you as well. Now, with adolescents, you got to, of course, expect some typical adolescent behavior by, oh boy, here we go again.
Sure.
That's the crap mom learned on her podcast. Right? And that's where you could, the nice thing about this, be totally transparent. You're like, yeah, I am trying to learn some things. But just to be clear, all I'm trying to learn is to really listen to you first.
Right.
Instead of just telling you what I think we should do. And I do hope that you'll listen to what I have to say too. And then we try to come up with some solutions. So that is what I'm trying to do. And you can be totally transparent about it.
So there's some training, I would guess, for parents in just this notion of counting to 30 is really important. Like we as parents, I don't know that we were trained to count to 30.
I mean, let's be clear. Most of us were trained that we're not even having this conversation.
Right. What I say.
We're the parent.
Goes, right.
Right.
So that was just totally wrong. From whoever created that back in caveman days when they were pounding like on some big boulder with a log, like that was just totally wrong.
I mean, it wasn't wrong back then. And there are times and circumstances in which using power and control to attain quick compliance is important.
Okay.
But in the world that we live in now that the kids have to navigate, no,
it doesn't work
that great. And look, it's a testament to the power of child and human development that even though we don't explicitly try to teach these skills most of the times with our kids, most kids actually learn them decently.
Yes.
Okay.
Right.
But what's happening now, unfortunately, is there's all kinds of things that have happened in the world that have actually delayed our kids' skills. I mean, if you, you know, you look at data from every public school system around, kids are not where they should be.
Yes.
And that's because the pandemic actually delayed skill growth. So we actually need to explicitly practice these kinds of skills with our kids. I mean, this is one of the reasons we are seeing a dramatic rise in mental health challenges.
Yeah, so that's really interesting because it there's, you know, we kind of opened up this conversation by saying there's a lot of things going on that are trying to solve for, you know, this impact of social media on our kids' lives. And it's really hopeful to me in having these conversations, learning more about your strategies, that literally every parent who wants to can lean into and start using this actually simple strategy. Although it takes patience and I think you do need to skill build on the adult side.
You have to practice.
Yeah. But it really, you know, all of us kind of have to lean in and help shift or, you know, grow from how deeply our kids were impacted by the pandemic.
Absolutely.
It's unbelievable, actually, how much stress that created in their lives. Yeah.
Well, this is the thing. I mean, this is why, like, you know, five-year-olds look more like 2 or 3 year olds these days. Eight-year-olds look like 5 year olds. And it keeps going. 17-year-olds can look like 14-year-olds.
Right.
25-year-olds don't look like 25-year-olds used to look. And it's because expectations kept marching along, including grade level expectations for learning, but skills didn't keep pace. And why didn't skills keep pace? Well, because everybody was stressed like crazy.
Right.
And despite heroic efforts from educators and parents, the rich environment that creates learning wasn't present.
Yeah.
So skills didn't advance, but expectations did. And there was a big gap. And that's where you see challenges, is the gap between expectations and skills. And then some kids also were exposed to real chronic stress and trauma,
right,
which also causes skill regression.
Right.
And then that gap is even bigger.
So is there, I'm just thinking a little bit about that. Are there ways to notice in your child if they are more deficient at these particular skills? I think there's a piece of this also, which we're missing compassion for, because we can't say that's dyslexia, that's a learning disability, that's a whatever. All we see it as is this dysregulated child.
Yep.
You know, we live in this world where if we can put a diagnosis on it, then we can lean into having compassion for it. But because there's not yet, and I don't love like that we label everything, right? Because then you kind of also can become the label.
Yep.
But is there a way for parents to notice, maybe my child is not as, has not yet developed these skills? I need to move from a place of compassion.
So you are hitting on something so important. Because, you know, one of the things we constantly try to study in our work, we've shown some pretty dramatic results in all kinds of different settings.
Yeah.
And one of the things we're always trying to study is, what is it? This goes back to my graduate school work. What is it about what we're teaching people that is so effective?
Yeah.
And I'm convinced that more than half of it is actually not the techniques of the process. It's the shift in mindset.
Yeah.
From kids do well if they wanna, I just gotta make them wanna, to kids do well if they can, to my kids doing the best they can to handle this very tricky situation with the skills they have. And some of these skills may be quite taxed right now. That vantage point, that perspective positions you in a really empathic place.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing about that is when we are feeling that way, we're much more empathic. We're much calmer ourselves because we don't take these things as sort of a personal affront or challenge to our authority as a parent. That's very dysregulating for us. So it's calming for us, but also empathy is the greatest human regulator we have. Being empathic with somebody regulates them.
Right.
And dysregulation is contagious. So when our kids get dysregulated, we go there with them. But the nice thing is regulation is also contagious. It is literally how infants learn how to regulate themselves. And so us staying regulated is crucial. And this mindset shift is perhaps the biggest piece of that.
Yeah, it is interesting because as we were going through this exercise, I never felt elevated.
Uh-huh.
Right. It's, you know, whereas like that, like coming into this conversation and thinking about the problem solution, it was dysregulating,
right? Yeah.
You know, which is, it's just so interesting to know that like actually when you're in the vibe of it, it feels fine.
And this is where, you know, I think it's so overwhelming to say to parents, you need to be having these conversations with your kid, right? About these really difficult things. If you have a roadmap, some guideposts.
Yeah.
Okay. And you know, one of the things we didn't talk about is you don't even have to do these three ingredients all in one discussion. You can say, you know what? On the ride home today, I am simply going to try to practice ingredient number one and see if I can learn about my kid's perspective.
Right.
And then at a later point, I'll reflect those back and see if I got them and move on to the second ingredient.
Right.
Okay. So having something to hang on to for a problem solving process, that too is very regulating for us.
I have to say, going through this with you, Stuart, it feels so easy and stabilizing as a parent.
just wait till you try it, Jill.
It's
hard when you try it.
No, I have to say, actually, yeah. I've been practicing this, because we've been studying your work, and so I've been doing this, and I think I told you about yesterday where we were in a video shoot, and so I was using all of my skills just via text.
Right.
But we had a very good conversation. I let her come up with the solution. I thought about it for a minute and I leaned into it. And then I thanked her for collaborating with me.
And you showed that you could do it over text too.
Yeah.
Which is interesting. And, you and I were talking yesterday. Sometimes for some kids, that's easier.
Yeah,
too.
Totally.
Because it's not, one of the most dysregulating things we can do for our kids is sit them down and say, we're going to have a conversation. Let me look you in the eyes. Yeah. It's very dysregulating.
And tone is dysregulating.
So this way, the other thing is, on text, it gives both parties an opportunity to think and start typing and say, let me not say that.
Hold on. Exactly. Exactly.
Right?
Exactly. Yeah. So this is great. Thank you very much for sharing this with us. Thank you for sharing it with all of our listeners.
Thank you. And thank you to the Shaw Foundation to bring this forward and apply our work, particularly in this setting. And I'm anxious to hear from folks of how helpful it is and where they struggle. And hopefully we can help people troubleshoot too.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you. Thank you for listening to my conversation with Dr. Stuart Ablon. To learn more about Stuart's work, go to thinkkids.org. And to learn more about social media and kids, go to yourbrainonsocialmedia.org. We hope that you enjoyed this episode of Deep Dives, and if you did, please rate, review, like, and share it with your friends. Have a great day.